Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist Seymour Hersh reports this week that the Pentagon is conducting covert operations in Iran, that the military option is an open one, and an Iranian campaign is next on the Bush agenda. Publicly, the president has been urging diplomacy, but privately, Hersh writes, the administration has been looking at more aggressive paths to take out, target, Iran's nuclear facilities. The Pentagon has called Hersh's report riddled with errors, but Hersh has been right before, at My Lai, at Abu Ghraib, and more. And by all accounts, the course the U.S. will take to handle the nuclear weapons ambitions of Tehran remains unclear and loaded with implications for the Pentagon and the larger war on terror. Tonight on Point, Iran, its nuclear ambitions, and the changing shape of the American military's role in response and beyond. Joining me now from Washington is Seymour Hersh, two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter. He writes for The New Yorker. His article in this week's issue of the magazine is The Coming Wars, What the Pentagon Can Now Do in Secret. Seymour Hersh, welcome to On Point.
Glad to be here. Again.
Again, good to have you back. You keep doing this little thing called breaking stories. So the Pentagon says you've got it wrong. I want to talk about that. You're putting out a great big case here for how intelligence and covert operations are changing, and we'll get to that. But I wish you'd dive in first on what's going on with Iran. You're reporting that the U.S. military has been conducting secret reconnaissance missions inside Iran since at least last summer. What are you saying has gone on, is going on there?
Well, they're not always there, and of course, we don't go in, you know, with fife and drums and singing Yankee Doodle Dandy. We're under deep cover, and it's almost, you know, I'm sure it's very professionally run. These all began back last summer when George Tenet was still in the CIA, and the CIA was deeply involved in this, too, in coordinating it. Basically, the goal is simply the administration is very eager to find three or four dozen sites that not only include real and suspected nuclear sites, but also missiles where they produce missiles and test missiles, and also chemical warfare, sort of the WMD again. And unlike, you know, they don't want to repeat what happened in Iraq, and so they're taking an extraordinary amount of care to really try and come up with some, I would even venture, empirical evidence that Iran is cheating as much as Washington thinks it is.
Now, this comes into a situation where Iran has clearly got a significant nuclear program. They've been playing kind of cat and mouse about their ambitions, but everyone believes they have nuclear weapons ambitions. Europe has been negotiating, trying to steer them off that course. The United States sitting sort of threateningly on the side. President Bush saying just last weekend that he preferred a diplomatic approach, but he couldn't take the military option or wouldn't take it off the table. And you're saying it's already moved ahead, and not through the CIA, but through the Pentagon.
Yes, and of course the president's, you know, look, one thing you have to do is take George Bush at his word. You know, it seems clear, and he's been doing a lot of talking before his inauguration tomorrow, and he's been saying amazing things. In an interview with the Washington Post, he said the war on terror we're going to win this war on terror, we're going to continue to fight it, we're going to make the Middle East democratic, we're going to prevail in Iraq, it's just a blip. He really believes that it's his mission, whether God's will or doing what his father couldn't do. His mission is not only to overcome the Iraqis and turn it into a democratic paradise, but also the rest of the Middle East. He's very clear about that. And so here's a president that says, yes, I'm eager for the diplomatic route, but what is he really doing? This administration has not supported the almost a year and a half of diplomacy between the EU, largely through the good faith efforts of Germany, France, and England, with the Iranians. We stayed on the sidelines. We haven't done a thing to support it. And in the article, I quote diplomats, European diplomats, saying they're terrified to say it by name. They don't dare do it because nobody wants the wrath of America. But basically, America, they feel, has put diplomacy in a lose-lose position. If America doesn't join in the diplomacy and isn't offering to make some guarantees of no first strike against Iran, there's no reason for Iran to support or go along with the Europeans. So it's a dead issue.
Let's track it from the Pentagon back up to the president and his big vision. You described civilians in the Pentagon, your words, wanting to go into Iran and destroy as much of the military infrastructure as possible. There you're quoting a government consultant that you describe as having close ties
to the Pentagon. Who in the Pentagon? With what kind of depth of ambition in Iran in particular?
Well, the people in the Pentagon obviously are the same group, the same boys that bought us Iraq. Paul Wolfowitz is one of the undersecretaries of Defense for Policy, Douglas Feith, Rumsfeld himself, the undersecretary for Intelligence, Stephen Cambone, what we call neocons, neoconservatives. They have been pushing very hard. And here's their outline. Their goal, their thinking is, and this what I'm telling you now is literally their thinking, that a series of coordinated series of attacks in Iran that could wipe out the facilities I talked about with little collateral damage. I don't think anybody's going to target anything in downtown Tehran, too dangerous. Would undercut the authority of the ruling mullahs, the clerics who run it, the theocracy, and therefore, in this line of thinking, the millions and millions of secular Iranians who don't like the religious leadership will rise up. It'll give them an opportunity. Once they see that the religious leaders are not as powerful as they claim to be, they will rise up and do the right thing and turn the government away from being a religious one into a secular one. This is the thinking of those people, and that's why they argue for these missions. And anybody who disagrees, either inside the Pentagon or in the CIA, the intelligence community, anywhere in the government, and not only in the military and in the administrative and intelligence offices, but also in the bureaucracy, in academics, almost everybody else that I talk to says, wow, this is Looney Tunes. The reality is that the Iranians, and whatever calling they have, will rally around their leadership. As much as they may hate the leadership, they will rally around it if we attack. We will do anything, quite the contrary. We'll increase the nationalism, increase the threat to America. But if you make that argument, you can't get to the table. They won't let you into the room to make that argument. In order to get into the room, you have to drink the Kool-Aid, Tom.
But you're saying, and you're reporting, that even before the election, the presidential election, but certainly with President Bush's victory, this has been taken, despite all the debate during the campaign, not as a cautionary sign for the aggressive war on terror, but as a kind of green light, that it's a big green light now, that the neocons are not sidelined, as was thought just, 6 weeks ago, when Donald Rumsfeld's future as the Secretary of Defense was reputed to be in question. You're saying, no, they see President Bush's victory as a green light for much more ambitious operations, perhaps in Iran, first of all.
Listen about Rumsfeld. The President of the United States, after 9/11, said, I want to smoke bin Laden out of his snake holes, and Donald Rumsfeld does it. Donald Rumsfeld is it's impossible to get rid of Rumsfeld. He is part of it. It's Cheney and the President and Rumsfeld. They're together. They're like one. There's no way Rumsfeld is running this war, and as you said in the opening, he's even been given much more authority in the last couple of months by the president.
Well, you say that he has, but the Pentagon's chief spokesman, Lawrence Derrida, came out over the weekend to say that your article was, quote, so riddled with errors of fundamental fact that the credibility of his, that's Seymour Hersh's, entire piece is destroyed. That's a pretty sweeping condemnation of your reporting.
Oh, he said a lot more than that. It was a page and a half of basically a personal vitriol. Absolutely.
You've been fed rumor, innuendo, assertions about meetings that never happened, programs that do not exist, statements that were never made.
Absolutely. The last time I ran across this guy, I had written a lot about Abu Ghraib, and I had suggested in a bunch of stories for The New Yorker in the summer of May and June of 2004, last year, and I had suggested in the third piece that what happened in Abu Ghraib was not isolated. We just have photographs. That's why it was so special. But we're doing terrible things in Guantanamo. We're doing terrible things in Afghanistan, elsewhere in Iraq. It goes to the top, leadership, Rumsfeld, the president, the vice president. And Derrida then said I was throwing crap, that was the word he used, against the wall and seeing what sticks.
And, of course, we know what happened there. But let me ask you, Seymour Hersh, in your own piece, you write, it is possible that some of the American officials who talk about the need to eliminate Iran's nuclear infrastructure are doing so as part of a propaganda campaign aimed at pressuring Iran to give up its weapons planning. Everyone seems to agree that the United States military is really stretched. Is it possible that even you are being used to try and kind of intimidate Iran with this reporting? Is that what you're suggesting, that possibility?
You have to know that, you know, as you do know, since 9/11, I've been doing literally an alternative history is a perfectly adequate expression.
Yes, we've seen it.
And I've been dealing with people, some of whom I've known as, you know, many years here in this town, long of tooth. Some of the people I've dealt with for 10, 20 years, and there's no question And although that possibility always exists for many people in this government, because there's a lot of talking about Iran and threats being made by John Bolton in the Pentagon and the State Department, the people that talk to me, their concern is really transcends this. Their concern is that what was a flourishing democracy in America, that right now there is more concentrated power to run intelligence operations and analysis in the Pentagon and the White House than ever before since the rise of the national security state. But the CIA...
You're talking after World War II, you mean by that?
Absolutely. And all I can tell you is that the CIA has been neutered, really, in the last few months by this administration. And Rumsfeld and his people have been giving enormous power to run covert operations, power that they've never had before, to run deniable operations anywhere around the world without telling Congress.
I wish you'd describe that for us. You quote one source saying that the Pentagon is a 500-pound gorilla and the CIA director is a chimpanzee today. You're reporting that President Bush has signed a series of top secret findings and executive orders authorizing secret commando groups and other special forces military units to conduct covert operations against terrorist targets in as many as 10 nations. Not all of our listeners will understand what's changed with those authorizations, Seymour Hersh.
When covert operations are run by the United States, they've always been run. That is deniable operations. We're not sending people as military men in undercover missions. We're sending them in as what they call white clean, is the cliche. Americans with given different passports, different IDs. Those kind of operations are run by our CIA, which that's one of the missions of the CIA, the Department of Operations Group, the so-called Dirty Tricks Department.
Mm-hmm.
Since the scandals in the mid-1970s involving domestic spying and the attempted assassination of foreign leaders, you know, stories that I...
Central America, Latin America, and all the rest.
Right. The stuff I did for the New York Times, a lot of stuff had to do way back then. Since then, Congress has tightened up the laws enormously. When the CIA does an operation overseas, the president has to approve in a written finding, they call it, has to be briefed to the House and Senate Intelligence Committees and other relevant committees, and the briefing must be extensive and quick. Not everybody has to know, but both parties, Democrat and Republican.
But if it moves to the Pentagon, don't have to give that briefing?
If it is the way the White House sees it, and of course every lawyer disagrees on this, it's not clear, but this is the way the White House interprets the law. If the Pentagon runs an operation, it's not intelligence, it's military, and the President of the United States, as Commander-in-Chief, has every right to send advanced teams in there to prepare the battlefield.
That's the kind of legal structure for it, prepare the battlefield.
And then nobody can be briefed. And not only that, you can go into a nation, and one of the countries I mentioned is Tunisia, North Africa is of great interest. And there's nothing, by the way, going after terrorism quickly and hard is certainly a virtuous idea for us anyway.
Right.
It's just who, how, when.
You say right now, you quote someone saying it's a global free fire zone, and others saying we're going to be riding with the bad boys. In Iran, in particular, you report that the United States has cut a deal with the Pakistanis that Washington would not go after their nuclear weapons national hero, A.Q. Khan, in return for their help in tracking down Iranian nuclear facilities that they may have worked with in the past.
Yes, Iran and Pakistan worked together about 15 years ago secretly. We were told this 2 years ago by the International Atomic Energy Agency. They revealed it. And that's one of the reasons we began to get on Iran's case, all this secret work with the PACs. But the Pakistanis, Musharraf, our friend, has now been slipping us intelligence to help us find his former allies' facilities. And in return, we say A.Q. Khan, the famous father of the atomic bomb, is sort of the cliche about him.
In Pakistan,
the man who ran all of the black market activities, he has not been made available by Musharraf to either the International Atomic Energy Agency or to American intelligence agencies for interrogations. They've all been done by the Pakistanis, and we get the fruit of it, whatever that means.
The fruit that may be leading American troops, or as you're reporting, has already led American forces.
Well, the point being, we'd still like to know what A.Q. Khan did. Because right now Pakistan is still in the market for nuclear materials in the black market. The other point about riding with the bad boys is this. What you have to do, what the Rumsfeld has determined in this proactive way, is we're going to send teams in the areas where we know there's terrorist activity. We're not going to tell the American ambassador or the CIA station chief there or maybe even the leading military guy in the field. We're going to go in covertly. We're going to start doing bad stuff, running with the bad boys. To find terrorists, you have to do terrorism. To find guys who want to sell nuclear weapons, you have to be willing to buy nuclear parts.
And with that, we're off to the races in Iran and maybe elsewhere. Seymour Hersh, I know we have to let you go. You've got a lot of pots boiling here. We're going to be looking into them. Thank you so much for joining us.
A pleasure always.
Seymour Hersh, Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist with The New Yorker. His article in this week's issue of the magazine is The Coming Wars. what the Pentagon can do now do in secret. You can join the conversation tonight. We're talking about Iran, its nuclear ambitions, about U.S. strategy in the Pentagon. Seymour Hersh reports special ops already underway in the region. Does that sound credible to you? How far should the U.S. go with an aggressive response to Iran's nuclear program with covert operations? Join us, 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Iran's nuclear ambitions, world response, and a report that the Pentagon is positioning to go on the offensive. You can join the conversation tonight. Are you shocked at reports, Seymour Hersh's report, that U.S. commandos have already been active inside Iran? Or would you expect the Pentagon to be responding that way to this threat? Is the military option a real option in dealing with Iran's nuclear weapons ambitions, or is it a recipe for disaster? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined tonight from Washington by Patrick Claussen. He's Deputy Director of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Patrick Claussen, good to have you back. Thanks for joining us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
And with us from London, Peter Siegel, defense correspondent for the Financial Times. Peter Siegel, thank you for joining us.
Absolutely, Tom.
Peter, first to you, what do you make of Seymour Hersh's report? You know, he often comes out with a lot of detail, and he has a record of many times having been right, even though it sounds it can sound flamboyant at first. What do you make of this report?
Well, sure. I guess I'm a bit more skeptical for this reason. Let's just first say that Seymour Hersh has achieved more in his journalism career than I'm ever likely to do. But in talking to the Pentagon and in some of the same neocons and hawks that you were talking about earlier, there really is a general consensus that there is no military solution in Iran. There is no likelihood that another invasion scenario for the mere reason that the U.S. military is so overstretched at this point that they couldn't do anything like that. So we go to the next possible scenario, which is, I think, what Seymour Hersh is getting into, you know, strategic bombing of WMD sites, be they military, be they nuclear. The problem is
That's a military option, isn't it, Peter?
Exactly. But the problem with that option is no one knows where these nuclear sites are. And I think it is, are there commandos running through Iran looking for WMD sites? I guess it's possible. Certainly, I would hope that the CIA, at least, is attempting to find out where these sites are. But I think after the Osiris bombing, when the Israelis bombed the Iraqi nuclear program.
Iranian program.
No, sorry, this is back
in 1981.
But when the Israelis bombed Osiris, which is the Iraqi facility,
yes.
The Iranians took a message from that. They moved all their nuclear programs underground. It is spread out throughout the country in maybe dozens of sites. And the people you talk to in the Pentagon, and again, this goes to the neocons as well, they realize that they would not be able to take out these sites in a single, even multiple strikes. For that reason, they actually have been backing the Europeans on this negotiation. I mean, I just talked last week to someone very senior in the State Department who is actually rather hawkish on these issues. And he says, look, we're willing to give the Europeans a shot because there is no military option at this point. And there is all the expectation that somehow the Iranians will probably back out at the last point, cause some sort of brinksmanship. They'll probably break down. I think the neocons are anticipating that.
That is back out of their negotiations with the Europeans.
Exactly. Just to say, throw their hands up and say, look, we are allowed to do a nuclear program under the Non-Proliferation Treaty. It's for civilian use. It's not for nuclear use. However, they're in a corner right now. They don't have much leverage otherwise. And at this point, they're allowing the Europeans to go ahead. And they've given the Europeans, their support to this point. They're between a rock and a hard place. There is no military solution there. Are there intelligence units looking for these? I assume so. I tend to doubt there are, these commando units. I think he uses some showy words here. I have no doubt there are intelligence units trying to find out. And Iran, frankly, is a bit more penetrable than Iraq was.
Now when we've got troops in both Iraq and Afghanistan on its western and eastern borders.
Well, even before September 11th, I mean, Iraq was a police state. It was a totalitarian state in which if you were found to be betraying the state, you were killed. Iran is a bit more pluralistic. I mean, I think we, acts of evil, we tend to group these all together. But the Iranian government is is much more splintered. You do have moderates who are actually elected into a parliament. Now, it's a little bit of a rubber stamp. They have no real power. But there is a power base there. You have the mullahs. You have the military. You have different elements at play. And in Iranian society, it tends to be much more open. I've talked to people who are diplomats in Tehran, and people don't like to talk to Westerners. But it's not a police state like Iraq was.
And you're saying that might create opportunities. Patrick Claussen, you've written that the military options in Iran don't look good, but if there was a path, it would be through covert operations. So do some interpretive reading of Seymour Hersh for us. He quotes you at one point here. How do you read what he's laying out? How do you interpret what you're reading here?
Well, he gets a little breathless about some relatively limited facts. For instance, he suggests that the United States is collecting intelligence inside Iran about Iran's nuclear program, and I would certainly hope so. That's the responsibility of our intelligence agencies, collecting information also about sites that might be targets if military strikes are ordered. And again, that's something that the military does an awful lot of. That's most of what the Defense Intelligence Agency does with the billions of dollars that it has. And only by collecting this kind of intelligence are we going to have a good idea as to whether or not, in fact, we know where Iran's military nuclear program is. The International Atomic Energy Agency has sent a lot of inspectors into the country. We found out a lot about the program, and we need to learn as to just how good is our information.
Does it sound credible to you that Pakistani nuclear program employees or others may be assisting the United States in scoping out Iran's hidden nuclear facilities?
And that would make excellent sense. At the time that Iran was getting assistance from Pakistan, the relationship between those two governments was pretty good, but the relationship now is not particularly good, and therefore it would make sense that some of these Pakistanis would decide to be ordered by the Pakistani government to cooperate with the U.S. and figure out exactly it is what the Iranians have done with the information that Pakistan provided them.
And what about the notion that neoconservatives, civilian administrators at the Pentagon see President Bush's reelection as a green light, in this case, to mount covert operations and then targeted attacks on Iranian nuclear facilities outside of urban areas in the hope that this would trigger a kind of revolt against the mullahs?
No one's talking about that yet. I mean, we are involved in a diplomatic process which this administration is reasonably confident is going to work.
Well, how can you say no one's talking about it? I mean, people have talked about that for some years now.
If certainly. What they've talked about is we ought to have plans for how to do that, and it's important that we do have plans how to do that, because if the Iranian government were to do something remarkably dumb, like announce that it has nuclear weapons or test them and announce that it's going to carry out its plans to wipe Israel off the map, which it frequently pledges that it will do, then we're going to have real problems on our hands. And we may, even though the military options are terrible, they'd be a whole lot better than seeing Israel wiped off the map. And so we ought to have plans for how to do that. But I think it's far-fetched to suggest that there's anybody in any position of responsibility who thinks those plans should be implemented now. There is a diplomatic process underway that seems to have frozen the Iranian program, and if we can keep that program frozen, look, the neocons and my good friends, the neocons, myself included, are quite optimistic that, in fact, the Iranian regime is going to fall of its own weight. And if you think the Iranian regime is going to fall of its own weight, then there's no particular reason to use these military strikes, which would only cause outrage throughout Europe. Even if we don't know what they do inside Iran, we certainly know that an awful lot of Europeans and others around the world would be upset about it. A lot of Democrats would be upset about it.
Neocons have upset Europeans and Democrats before. It
hasn't stopped
them.
I don't think it's been a spectacular success.
Wall Street Journal is saying today there's a problem with the EU's diplomacy always works philosophy.
Well, in fact, what we've seen is that the EU adopted a statement about counterproliferation last June, in which they said flatly that it's not just a process that counts, it's the results that you get, and that if the results aren't satisfactory, that the use of force it could be an effective way for counterproliferation. And the French Mr. Chirac, the other day, was saying that if Iran were found to be cheating that it should expect the worst consequences. So, in fact, the Europeans have been pretty tough. Not only have they insisted that Iran has to give up its nuclear program, but they've also said that with the Iranians, you want a deal, we got to talk about your support for terrorism, your opposition to the existence of Israel, and your human rights record as well, by the way.
Right on down the line. Patrick Claussen in Washington, Peter Siegel in London, please stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation from St. Andrews, Scotland, Ali Ansari. He's a professor of history at the University of St. Andrews, author of Modern Iran Since 1921 in Iran, Islam, and Democracy. Ali Ansari, thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
How do you hear this conversation with your Iranian ear? Tehran came out and said, if the U.S. military messes with us, we'll mess right back with the United States. They also said that Seymour Hersh's report was a kind of effort to intimidate them, and they rejected it.
Well, I tend to agree that some parts of Seymour Hersh's article has been, in a way, has been sort of sexed up, if we can use that phrase. I don't see myself that, as previous speakers have said, that there are sort of swarms of American commandos, you know, roaming around Iran. I think it would be it's certainly an easier country to get into. It's certainly in many ways accessible, but there's also, you know, the capabilities and abilities of people to sort of blend into society and seek out information and sort of get this sort of human intelligence, which I know certainly some Western countries have had problems with. But I think some of the allegations being made are certainly going to be felt quite strongly in Iran. I think the dangers of some of these allegations is that it will be taken by hardliners as a sort of an indication of hostilities. And this sort of thing is a bit concerning, and I think that's why it's quite important that the State Department and other bodies in the United States have come out quite strongly to sort of deny some of these stories, because it could be taken certainly the wrong way by those elements in Iran who really would like to develop some form of confrontational stance and take the Cold War into a sort of a hot war situation with the United States. And that, I think, is something that would certainly be of concern to myself, as well as to, you know, many Europeans who are clearly trying to continue a rather painstaking and long-winded negotiation with the Iranians at the moment.
Tehran's top nuclear negotiator, Hassan Rouhani, came out this week saying that suspension of enrichment, which the Europeans had pushed so hard for, is for a limited period to win the confidence of the international community, suggesting that once that confidence is won, enrichment comes back. That means progress toward nuclear weapons. Is there a military option if Iran continues one way or another to stride toward nuclear weapons?
There are enormous pressures, I mean, within Iran itself. It's quite interesting that Rouhani is under enormous amounts of criticism from this new hardline parliament, which, you know, incidentally, we all are aware of was elected under the most dubious of grounds. But, I mean, Hassan Rouhani, who is himself a sort of what we would call a pragmatist conservative, but certainly on the more conservative wing, is under enormous pressure from hardliners for being too soft with the Europeans. But it's quite clear that a whole raft of people, including the pragmatists as well as probably the reformists and others, are saying that, no, you know, we have to take these extra steps to ensure that we can win the trust of the international community. Now, under the old non-proliferation treaty, of course, Iran does have a sovereign right to enrich uranium if it wishes. I mean, the problem is that this treaty is in many ways, and certainly those in the West would argue, is somewhat outdated given the technological advances, so extra checks have to be made. But Iran also has this, what we have to understand in a way is Iran has this enormous sort of nationalistic urge and drive to be modern, to be technologically advanced. It sees that the way that the United States is, in a sense, picking on Iran is unfair. It's working up the public mood. It's saying that, you know, we have this right, and it wants to give the impression, certainly, that it is driving a hard bargain with the Europeans or anyone else. It doesn't want to give at all the impression that it's been soft at all, or it's been forced to compromise or back down. So I think some of this rhetoric is also partly an aspect of sort of the internal political fray, and they have to show at the end of the day that, look, you know, whatever agreement we've come to with the Europeans, you know, we got the best possible deal, maintaining our sort of national dignity and so on and so on.
Ali Ansari, let me ask you finally on that point, to take Seymour Hersh's reporting at face value for a minute. He has often been right before. He says there are still American neocons who calculate that if they would go in, blow up a handful, a half dozen, a dozen nuclear sites, not in urban areas, in Iran, that the Iranian populace would rise in revolt against the mullahs and it would be a new day in Iran, more democratically oriented. How do you see that?
Well, there's two things I would say on that which are quite important. One is that I think this notion that suddenly the Iranian populace will rise up against the mullahs is somewhat simplistic. I think that a lot depends on how these things are handled. Clearly, there's also a general sort of sentiment of nationalism and national unity, and it's entirely possible, of course, that an attack of any sort or any sort of infringement of national sovereignty is going to put people right in back into the, you know, back into the hands of the mullahs, now taken as a general sense. The other aspect that I do think, however, that Seymour Hersh has done a great service about, in actual fact, is to raise this, to raise the alarm, so to speak, that there are people within the Pentagon who do think like this, that there are people within the Pentagon who do think that Iran is the next stage in this great crusade on the war on terror. And I don't think actually people either in Iran, in actual fact, or even in Europe have actually taken this prospect seriously, because most people, certainly on this side of the Atlantic, think, well, you know, the Americans have had this experience in Iraq and they're too busy with that at the moment, that things have not gone very well and they're not going to want to extend the war any further. It's well worth reminding ourselves that in actual fact there is a group of people who think that the situation in Iraq is going well and that this is just, you know, the next stage, or, you know, the solution to Iraq certainly may lie through Tehran, for instance.
One step in a big parade.
Sorry?
One step in a big parade. Ali Ansari, I know we have to let you go, but thank you very much for joining us tonight from St. Andrews, Scotland.
Thank you.
Ali Ansari, Professor of History at the University of St. Andrews. Patrick Claussen, one thing Seymour Hersh makes much of in this piece is the intelligence operations being sort of pulled out of the CIA, handed to the Pentagon, where they're not subject to congressional oversight, and when they can go ahead with commando moves or, as he describes it, almost anything else they'd like, the suggestion being that this could make things move much more quietly and unexpectedly from intelligence into military action.
Well, let me ask you a question. Do you think that if the CIA went up to Congress and said, hey, we'd like permission to do some covert operations to collect information about Iran's nuclear program, do you think there's a single member of Congress who'd say, oh, no, you shouldn't do that. My goodness gracious.
That
might annoy them. So what Mr. Hersh is describing are really quite uncontroversial kinds of things. And when he talks about some of the operations which the military is doing, he's talking about taking sensors, which are pretty hefty items, and inserting them out there someplace in the desert so they can sense the air.
But you
well,
say it's
kind of hard to pack that in your suitcase and bring it along. So the idea that the military is going to use a helicopter in order to bring that stuff in from neighboring Pakistan or Afghanistan, you know, I don't think that there's going to be a lot of controversy about that idea.
You say uncontroversial, and I understand, but nevertheless, the laws requiring CIA reporting that emerged in the 80s after some fiascos in Central America, Latin America, were there for a reason. There was controversy at that time.
There's controversy about a lot of covert operations which the CIA was engaged in. I really don't think that there's a lot of controversy about the idea of the military collecting information about another country's nuclear program. We did a heck of a lot of that during the Cold War. There were an awful lot of situations in which, in fact, personnel went into the Soviet Union in order to collect information about the Soviet Union's nuclear programs and their war plans. So there's a long tradition of doing this, and it makes excellent sense. Now, if Mr. Hersh came along and said to me that, hey, the CIA, the U.S. military is trying to overthrow another government through covert operations, I'd be worried, but he doesn't say anything like that.
We've got it. Patrick Claussen in Washington. Peter Spiegel in London. Please stand by. We're talking tonight about Iran's nuclear ambitions, world response, and a report that the Pentagon is positioning to go on the offensive. What do you think? With the mess in Iraq, does the Pentagon have any business sniffing around Iran, or is it vital to be there? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Iran's nuclear ambitions and a report that the Pentagon is positioning itself to go on the offensive, may be on the offensive already. You can join the conversation tonight. What do you think? If U.S. commandos took out a dozen Iranian nuclear and missile sites, can you imagine Iranians overthrowing their government and rallying to Washington's cue? Do you still see a neocon move afoot to take on and shake up the whole Middle East? Is this the path to glory, or as Seymour Hersh reports it described, is this Looney Tune? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight from Washington by Patrick Claussen, Deputy Director of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, from London by Peter Siegel, Defense Correspondent for the Financial Times. Right now, Mike is calling from Spokane, Washington. Hi, Mike. You're on the air.
Yes, hi there. My comment is, I just came back from Iran 3 months ago, and I talked to many younger Iranian people.
Yeah.
And discussing this issue of, you know, what if, you know, United States attacks in Iran.
Mm-hmm.
And this, what it does, you know, basically it will reunite, you know, Iranians against their enemy, and regardless of who enemy is. And I think, you know, this would be a huge mistake, but by United States attacking to any facilities or invading Iran.
So what should the U.S. do if Iran does not back off its nuclear weapons program?
Well, United States, you know, there is, I'm sure there is a way to diplomatically, you know, solve this issue. And it's just a matter of, you know, we have to sit down, you know, with Iranians, regardless of, you know, we like them or we don't like them. I mean, we have done this with Chinese. We have done this, you know, with other countries, which, you know, they have, they were in a worse situations that, you know, Iran is currently.
Yes, but of course we accepted that they had the bomb, and so far Washington hasn't been willing to accept that notion in Iran. Mike, thank you for your call. Peter Spiegel, how about it? Is there confidence at some level in the U.S. government that there is a diplomatic way here? It seems to me that I don't see the evidence that there's that confidence.
Well, it depends on where you're talking about. I mean, obviously there are different levels of the administration, different agencies. I think the reason that there is so much buzz about it these days is they're a bit panicked that there is no diplomatic solution. They believe, mm-hmm. and I think, you know, I think everyone agrees that Iran has nuclear ambitions and has, frankly, no reason to stop pursuing that.
Mm-hmm.
The reason the diplomatic mission is the best of some bad choices is, you know, it freezes this. I think one of the other commentators said it does freeze things for a while. It slows things down. And I think the hope of this is just it's not the easiest thing in the world to develop a nuclear weapon. Let's slow this down as much as we can. Let's allow things to develop in the region and hope that at some point, you know, things change either inside Iran in terms of an overthrow or whatnot. I mean, this is why I think that Seymour Hersh makes this leap in between intelligence gathering and war fighting. I think the headline is something like the coming wars or whatnot.
Yes, that's right.
Let's remember where we are and take a step back in terms of what the Bush administration's priorities are for this second term. All we hear about is Social Security reform and the tax code and these types of things. This is not an administration, and drawing down troops in Iraq, mind you, this is not an administration that is really looking for foreign adventurism at this point.
Well, I don't know about that. Condoleezza Rice, just in the last 2 days, has been very explicit before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, saying we've still got a big global agenda to pursue freedom. She names six countries, including Iran, where there's, I forget the phrase, tyrants in charge, essentially. I mean,
been U.S. policy dating back for 20 years, that the Iranians support terrorism. They, you know, prior to al-Qaeda, you know, Iranian-backed terrorism has been the biggest killer of U.S. personnel anywhere in the world.
I have to say, the Bush administration, this one, has put that in a new context. Let me get another call. Charles is calling from Lexington, Kentucky. Charles, you're on the air.
Yes, sir.
What's on your mind, Charles?
Well, there's two things, actually. Earlier when you all talked about we have this covert operation over there in Iran, it reminded me of last night's news story where they were talking about Condi Rice being questioned by the members of Congress, I guess it is, and her saying that, well, our first, you know, priority and our first tool from now on is going to be diplomacy. And it just strikes me as, you know, just an about-face. And it reminds me of this seminar I went to in Florida where the management philosophy taught there was ready, fire, aim.
But can't a superpower have diplomacy and intelligence gathering going on at the same time?
I think that we need to do it without actually invading another country. I consider us sending personnel that are, you know, that are not known to the Iranians over there an invasion. I mean, we would consider it that for another country to do it to us.
Depending,
all we do by invading them in that regard, or even blowing up anything, my gosh, I can't imagine, is you turn all of them against us, just like the previous caller said.
Charles, thank you for your call. Patrick Claussen, you describe potential covert operations, at least you did last fall, against Iran, is not necessarily involving helicopters and commandos, potentially scrambling software.
Exactly right. I mean, there's lots of different ways in which one can imagine that these very complicated industrial sites where uranium is enriched could have problems. And it would be best if we could do it covertly rather than through overtly. But if we have to, we would have to consider overt strikes. By the way, when I was in Iran this summer, the first night I was there and went to a nice restaurant, had been sitting there for 5 minutes, and someone came over to me and said in English, "Are you from USA?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "You must remember, very important, you must to invade Iran." And I heard that same theme from taxi cab drivers and from other people. In fact, I was sharing an apartment for 2 months with 20 Iranians who didn't speak a word of English. My Persian's pretty good. And every day we would talk about whether or not it'd be good for the United States to invade Iran. And the opinion in the apartment was generally, that's the only way that we can see getting rid of the mullahs.
So I'm not saying
it's a good idea. I'm just telling you there's an awful lot of Iranians who want to get rid of these mullahs and would be just delighted if somebody else would do it for them.
And you're in the neocon circle. That seems to give credence to Seymour Hersh's reporting.
No, I'm just simply suggesting that it would be a big mistake for us to count on that being what would happen in the reaction if we actually did it. If we actually had to do this, if we actually had to take military action against Iran, it would be silly for us to think about invading it. In fact, it would be much more sensible to think about covert actions. It would be much more sensible to think about containment and deterrence the way we did with the Soviet Union during the Cold War. But at some point, if the Iranians announce that they've got a nuclear bomb and they're going to wipe Israel off the face of the map, what are you going to do about this situation? Are you going to let the Iranians do this?
It doesn't sound like Washington's in the mood to do that. Jamal's calling from Durham, North Carolina. Jamal, you're on the air.
Thank you. Well, I don't follow very closely what your guest is mentioning, you know, just because you talk to somebody in the restaurant and somebody tells you, you know, go on, you need to invade Iran, makes a lot of sense. The final analysis of this administration, regardless what it's going to be, is we are going to talk a lot of diplomacy, but in reality, it's going to be sooner or later to take at face value what Mr. Hersh has published. And I believe that he's 99% correct. Sooner or later, the United States is going to, in one way or another, have to dismantle, destroy, or in one way or another, disassemble the nuclear program in Iran.
And do you support that move, Jamal? Is it a wise move?
I don't support. I think that this is the mentality of the neocons currently in Washington. And they are in some kind of fallacy, you know, they are completely obscure in an irrational trajectory.
But Patrick Claussen says, are you going to let Iran have nuclear warheads on a missile that could hit Israel or Spain or Portugal?
I think that what the United States sooner or later is going to do right now is posturing, now that we have all these problems in Iraq and in Afghanistan, it's allowing the administration to take a hold into these two positions. You know, they were going to have elections in Iraq and we're going to have all these issues.
But sooner or later, you see it coming in Iran. Jamal, our time is short, but thank you for your call. Peter Spiegel, finally to you. Iraq is an awfully big millstone around the U.S. neck right now. Does that keep Washington from realistically having any military options in Iran?
Yeah, I mean, I think that was a point I was trying to make earlier. I mean, frankly, it's that's the wrong phrase to say it's a bit of a shame, but I think most analysts, on either side of the debate, will say at this point, probably even prior to the war, that Iran was much more dangerous. A nuclear-armed Iran, which supports Islamic Jihad, Hezbollah, is much more of a potential threat to actually strike with these nuclear weapons if they gain them. And I think because of the problems with Iraq and because we've had such a hard time now gaining global support for initiatives abroad, it really has hamstrung the administration in terms of what they can do in Iran.
That's pretty loud and clear right now. A lot of eye-openers tonight. Peter Spiegel with the Financial Times in London, thank you very much for joining us. And Patrick Claussen, Deputy Director of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy in Washington tonight, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, Colin Powell bows out. This is On Point. After a few more hours of grilling, Condoleezza Rice received the approval of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee today, paving the way for her confirmation by the full Senate as Secretary of State tomorrow. Only two of the committee's 18 members voted against Rice's nomination, former presidential nominee John Kerry and California's Barbara Boxer, who was among Rice's toughest questioners over the past 2 days. Meanwhile, across town, the man Rice will replace gave his farewell address. Colin Powell leaves with what is widely seen as a diminished reputation after 4 years under George W. Bush, but he told colleagues at the State Department in an emotional speech that, quote, "We have much to look back on with satisfaction. Here is more of Powell's goodbye."
You are the carriers of America's values. You are the ones that go out not to lecture, not to impose, but to let our works go before us, to show what democracy can bring to people in the way of a better life. You are the ones who demonstrate the importance of individual rights, that everybody should be free. You are the ones, by the way you do your job here, the way all of our people at our embassies around the world do their job in connecting with the citizens of that land. Tell those folks what America is all about, what we believe: freedom, human dignity, economic openness, all for the purpose of not imposing American values, but showing how American values can benefit the world if they are adjusted and adapted to the needs of a particular country. We've demonstrated that in the broader Middle East and North Africa as we have launched the Forum for the Future to help those nations reform themselves with our help. We have demonstrated in our continuing effort to work with the nations of the Middle East, and especially with the Israelis and the Palestinians, to move forward so that free, reformed, democratic state of Palestine can be created to live side by side in peace with Israel. We have not shrunk from the challenges. We are focusing on Iran and North Korea and trying to persuade them that there is a better way. We put the spotlight on these kinds of problems. We solved the problem in Libya of weapons of mass destruction. We hope other nations that are thinking in those terms will come to the same conclusion that the Libyans did. So we have much to be proud of, but you are the ones who should be proud of what we have done. It has been my privilege to serve you, but you are the foot soldiers of the battalion. I'm so proud that I have had this chance to serve my nation once again. And when I step down from this job, I will have had close to 40 years of government service. 35 of those years were in the United States Army. I will never not be a soldier. You can't serve for 35 years and say I'm no longer a soldier. So the Army will always be dear and precious to me. But I want to say to you here today that after 4 years of being with you, serving in this department, the relationship is the same. And even though I step down as your secretary, I will never leave you. I will always be part of this wonderful family. Thank you all, and God bless you.
Secretary of State Colin Powell saying goodbye to his State Department colleagues earlier today. On Point News analyst Jack Beattie joins me now. Jack, you could hear that voice thick with emotion there at the end, but also a dig before he got there, at least what sounded to me like a dig just at the opening of that quote, where he said, "You are the ones who go out not to lecture, not to impose, but to let our works go before us," kind of biblical quotation there. Colin Powell, I guess, was always the one, we're told, who didn't want to lecture, didn't want to impose, but let good works show their own face.
Unfortunately, the good works wouldn't cut it within the ferocious bureaucratic politics of the Bush administration. Paul Wolfowitz was asked, "Why did you take the job as deputy in the Defense Department?" He said, "To stop Powell." This was even before taking the job.
Stop Powell.
To stop Powell.
Such that a was, menace he was.
That's exactly, that's it. This menace to, I don't know what, neocon designs, that's for sure. And when you look at the trajectory of his career there, it's one humiliation after another. He starts out with Korea. He wants to continue with the Clinton policy. Bush cuts him off at the knees with the South Korean president right in the White House. Then he talks Bush into going to the UN, and he goes to the UN, and Dominic de Villepin, the French French foreign minister cuts him down again and says, we won't go to war on any grounds. Then he makes the terrible speech at the UN full of inaccuracies,
turns
and we
out.
Now know, mm-hmm. false claims. And finally, the bitter thing, the army is being destroyed, the army he cares so much about in Iraq.
And there goes Colin Powell. In comes Condoleezza Rice. Jack, thanks for being with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.